Well then, everybody, are we all getting on? Welcome to opposite episode, get me teeth in, episode 33 of the Alcohol Uncensored podcast. Every week we turn up and we talk about the same thing, albeit we put a very different slant on it each time we turn up. And we always talk about the benefits of what happens when you stop drinking. There's myself, I'm Ian. I am 6 years alcohol free. And I'll happily talk to you until the cows come home about the good things that happen when you stop drinking. And I am joined by the co-host with the co-most, Kelly Cooney. How are you getting on, Kelly?
I'm good, Ian. Thanks. I hit 11 months yesterday. Hey. 11 months, so sneaking towards the year again. I'm good. No complaints. I've just been plodding along, working away. The community's been good. It's kind of been bustling a little bit in the forum, which is nice. Yeah. I've had quite a few messages about asking about joining the community, so that's nice.
Excellent.
Yeah, no complaints.
So we're not scaring them off then, you reckon?
Not yet.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Well, we've got a cracking guest with us today, haven't we? We've got Andy Stone, who is a guy who we came across because another member of our community had listened to his podcast and said, guys, you've got to listen to this guy and you've got to try and get him on. So he did exactly that and reached out and messaged Andy and said, would you mind joining these guys? And he said he'd love to. So he put us in touch. So Andy, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to meet us today. How are you doing?
Yeah, Ian, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure. And yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Today is a good day.
I love your positivity. Is every day a good day?
No.
No. That's all right.
But you get on with them and then you thrive on these days. So it's all good.
Yeah.
Ride those waves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, a community member, Ben, put us on to you because he listened to your podcast, which was a couple of years ago. You did one with Sober Dave. I'm not going to do my Sober Dave impression because he'll then get me back one day and try and do an impression of me, which will sound horrendous. Yeah. But Sober Dave is a legend who I listen to like every week. I had like a set number of podcasts that I used to listen to. Over the Influence was one of them, and Sober Dave was the other one that I used to listen to one off the bounce every week. And he's just such a good guy, isn't he?
He's fantastic. I was super lucky to be invited onto those podcasts, and yeah, you're right, I think they're very easy to listen to, aren't they?
Yeah. But we're going to get into, I imagine we're going to cover quite a lot of topics today, Andy, and I won't sort of spoil it by sort of lunging into them now, but certainly ADHD is one topic that I know that is something that you can speak about with a sort of from a really strong point of reference, and I'm really keen to get into that and hear your sort of story. And like I was saying before we got started, what we tend to do is we ask our guests sort of go back to the start, if you like, and tell us, you know, what they were like in terms of their early drinking story, where it got them to, where it started to go wrong, and kind of, you know, how they picked up the pieces from there. Do you mind just going back to the very start and just sort of telling us a bit about your backstory, if that's all right?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Andy, and I'm an alcoholic, and I am ADHD, autistic, dyslexic, the full cliche. So I had a fairly normal time at primary school, just a boisterous boy. So I'm 45, so it would have been sort of 80s primary school, and things weren't too bad. But then it's when I got to high school age, things started to get really difficult. I was constantly disruptive, disobedient, just a pain in the ass in the classroom environment. I found it very, very difficult. ADHD wasn't really on anyone's radar, particularly in the sort of early 90s. But it's about the third year of high school. I was just constantly sent out of the classroom, sent to the head teacher's office, outside the staff room, constant bollockings. And to the point where in the end, they just said, you know what, just get your coat. And I did, and I left the comp, and then bless them, mum and dad, definitely got a second mortgage of what they flipping did, but they sent me to the local grammar school. They did all they could for me, and it was around this sort of time that I then got my first diagnosis for ADHD and dyslexia. Again, they had no idea what it was. They offered me stimulant medication, which no one knew what that was either, to be perfectly honest. And mum didn't put me on it because I was doing well with rugby. The one thing that gave me a fantastic outlet outside of school was sport. So swimming, judo, cricket, and then ultimately rugby. And I just took to it like a duck to water. It's just a big, boisterous guy, super high energy. And stuck me on a rugby field, and I played for town, county, got to regional. There was England scouts looking at me. Unfortunately, at the same time, sort of between that sort of age of 14 to 17, that kind of difficult sort of teen years, I was expelled from the grammar school as well because all the same issues were happening there as were happening in the state school. But they were good enough to sort of say, look, come back and sit your exams, just kind of have an extended study leave if you like. So school was stressful and difficult and awkward and frustrating. But then also it was spilling into home life. Like mum and dad were doing all they could. They sent me to the Dyslexia Institute. They were getting me into sport and trying to funnel me down that direction as best they could and driving me all over the place to play rugby and swim. But it just wasn't enough. And I'd fallen out with them by high school, by GCSE time. And I actually moved out of home at 16 to go and live with a mate. And I took my exams living away from home. And it was just a mess. And at that time, I then kind of, I was called a big guy. I was in pubs from sort of 15, 16 onwards. And I discovered alcohol, cannabis, ecstasy, cocaine, ketamine, magic mushrooms, all this kind of 90s illegal, illicit drug scene just all of a sudden just lit up. And I had no idea that it was a coping strategy. I just thought it was coming of age. You know, this is what guys do. It's not. If you want to be good at sport, you don't do any of that. And the sport just completely stopped. The England Scouts point that was at the end of, I don't know, under 16, so I'd have been just 17. And they said, come back, get fit over the summer. We'll look at you again next season. Your game knowledge is there. We just need you to just get in better shape. And instead of hitting the gym and getting a PT or what you would expect to do at that time, I just ran off into the nightclubs and got a job and a car, and that was that, really. So these two very kind of now looking back, obvious kind of coping strategies, the healthy sporting one and then the illicit drugs one. And sadly, drugs won and off I went. And for sort of the age of 17 to 20, I was just every weekend enjoying the kind of clubbing scene, if you like. So yes, the whole kind of late teens period of time was very, very difficult for me.
Just listening to you there, just thinking about, I think about some of the characters who I knew when I was younger, when I was that sort of age, you know, in your sort of like your late teens, getting into 20s, your formative years, if you know what I mean. And I think of some of the guys who, when I was at university in Leicester, and I met some real characters, and some of them went straight off the rails, you know. So and you know, I was very much confined myself to drink and a bit of other stuff, but I never really sort of, it was the drink for me mainly, you know. I dabbled with some of the things, but it was mainly drink. Some guys went at it full tilt, like you've just described there, and it makes you wonder how many of them might have just, like you said, that was their coping strategy.
Yep, absolutely. And I was fortunate in that I'd kind of met a girl. She was very straight-laced. She wasn't into the kind of drug scene, and she had a very, very positive impact on me. The drugs all stopped at sort of 20, 21, that kind of age, but the alcohol continued. And the disruption that the unaddressed ADHD was causing on my life, I didn't even see it as ADHD at the time. Or, you know, now I've been later diagnosed with autism as well, but I had no idea that that was what was causing my inability to function on a daily basis. Okay, the drugs had stopped, but the alcohol continued. I was from a drinking family. None of them have got a problem with it apart from me, bless them. But I was in a drinking culture from the lads that I still hung around with, family. So mum and dad lived in Wales. I lived in England. And every time I went to see them, it was just all fun times, you know, shut the gate, crack the bottle and all of that. So I never perceived as it being a problem in my 20s. And but what was a problem is that I just couldn't hold a job down for any longer. Like I'm 45 and I've had 68 jobs. So I would go from job to job to job to job. And I'm mostly in kitchens, pubs, restaurants, whatever. The beauty of that industry is there's always someone needs a chef, like right now. So it gave me the ability to go and get a job, get some money in, kind of sort my finances out enough, and then get frustrated, get wound up, hit the bottle, and then quit. And then it would happen. It was just this horrible repeating cycle. Right, okay, I'm going to sort this out. I'm going to go and get this job. I'm going to get have this interview. It's got this boss, this money, this potential. I'm going to go and do that. Yeah, it sounds great. All positive. And then a few months in, all the wheels would fall off. And it was like clockwork. But no one recognized that as ADHD. And so all I could see was my mates, missus, brother, cracking on with career jobs, getting degrees, mortgages, kids. The prospect of a mortgage or a baby was just absolutely mind-blowing for me because of my complete inability to adult, if you like. And I kind of got carried on with this. I got re-diagnosed as an adult with ADHD to be able to go through the NHS system for medication, which I did. So I was then on alcohol and Ritalin. But just struggling end of 20s, early 30s, particularly. So they put me on SSRIs, benzodiazepines, alcohol, and then cocaine was back at that stage. So I was drinking every day, and every other day there would be cocaine. And then the days that I hadn't had coke, it was a battle not to have it. So it was, had I had the money and the wherewithal, I would have had more cocaine if that was available. But my dosage was going up, my tolerance to alcohol was going up, the problems that alcohol and that addiction was then causing were going up. My ex-wife was my best mate on planet Earth. We were just meant to be. We'd been backpacking a couple of times, married at 25, together since I was sort of 16, 17, and it was just the most horrendous situation because I just got myself into this pickle in my 30s where I was oblivious to neurodiversity. Even though I'd had two diagnoses, I'd done nothing to research what it was. No one was telling me how to deal with those conditions. So it was five different strong mind-altering substances. So no way of telling what drug was doing what. They were all completely overlapping. What withdrawal from one felt like, what taking too much of another one felt like. It was just all this concoction of quite potent pharmaceuticals combined with drugs, cocaine and alcohol. And I just had no chance. I was just ambling along, grinding through life, complete victim mindset. Why can't I do what everybody else is doing? And it just came to a head. Like, my ex-wife couldn't be around me anymore. We then got divorced at that point, and I was just off into the wilderness, in the chaos, in the madness, call it what you like. And I was there in my 30s, and you would drink if you were me as well, and would just completely defend my addiction. That was my absolute solution, and it was absolutely okay. And I was drink driving, doing 15-mile round trips to go and get gear after, half a dozen pints. And then my required dosage on a daily basis at that point was the same sort of unitage of about a liter of vodka, mostly 3 pints of Stella and cider sitting in a pub, drink driving to around country pubs, do you know what I mean? Two in each, so you don't get collared. All these little sort of manipulative, naive, ignorant sort of techniques to give myself permission that what I was doing was socially completely acceptable. And of course it was just completely distorted and horrific behavior. But that's where I was. That's where it had gotten me to. And it was a very, very difficult, dark place to be. The prospect of suicide was getting more and more enticing, and it was spending more and more time in my mind because the prospect of going through the next 40 years feeling like that was just, it was just getting too much to bear.
It sounds absolutely horrific. I mean, I can resonate really a lot with it, but it's sad. Like, the whole thing is really sad, to the fact that you were just, and it's still, and it happens all the time, that you were just kept getting pills gave to you, just pills from the doctor. Like, what was that going to fix? And it just makes you think. Like, I love, obviously we'll speak about it in a minute, but I've seen the work you do on your website, going into schools and talking about it there, because you just wonder if someone had spoke to you all those years ago, like, this is ADHD, this is how it works, this is how you treat it. Oh, and by the way, if you drink alcohol, you've got no hope in hell being able to manage this because it makes it worse. Like, there was no conversations like that. Your life could have went on a completely different path if those conversations had been had. So I love the work that you're now doing to try and help others, but Yeah, it was to come out the other end of that, Andy, just massive kudos to you. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, it wasn't without help. That was for sure. Like I was living on my own by this point, drinking what I wanted, when I wanted, with who I wanted, which was normally me. There was probably two other guys that I could tolerate drinking with by this point. The rest of the time I was on my own. And it required my mum and dad to sit me down. Do you want to hear the story behind mum and dad actually giving me the intervention?
Yeah, let's hear
Right.
it.
So I was in between kitchen jobs, right? And I'd just been for a meeting with a guy that I knew previously. He just bought his own pub, and he's like, "I'm after chefs. Do you want to come work here?" Like, yeah, okay, let's come and have a look. Got offered the job, went home. I was my ex-wife. We still had two dogs at the time. They got rehomed, which is horrific enough on its own. I'm an incredibly doggy guy, and having to watch that. But anyway, that's another story. So I went back to her house while she was at work to walk the dogs. She left me a key out, because I wasn't allowed there anymore. And I was sitting with the dogs in her house. Mum and dad phoned. And I live 150 miles away in Wales. Like, "Hi, we're on the motorway. We're coming to see you." It's like, "Why?" "Can't really tell you. We're on our way. We've just been to see the bank manager, and we're coming to tell you something. Tell me over the phone. I've got a shift in half an hour's time. Like, don't worry about going to work tonight. We're coming to tell you something face to face." Phone down. Okay. So then, I don't know, I've had three or four pints by this stage just to sort of prepare me for work. So it's like, "Okay, so been to see the bank manager. Come to tell me now. Don't worry about work tonight. Will only tell me face to face. They've won the lottery." That's the only thing that I could think of. That's the only logic that I could draw from that situation. And of course, they got there 5 minutes before mum and dad arrived. My ex-wife walked in, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm still here." Like, "Yeah, I know. I spoke to your mum and dad." Like, "Why have you spoke to mum and dad?" And of course, three of them sat me down. It's like, "We think that you need rehab. That's not winning the lottery." And
Although when you look at where you are now, it kind of is.
well, yeah, absolutely. So, mum was then literally following me around the house. I just had this mad tantrum, like, "Absolutely not. What are you talking about? I don't need rehab. Andrew, they're on the phone. Will you talk to them?" "No, I can't ask you nicely again. Mom, please hang the phone up." Like, pacing around the house. And then went to work and left the three of them there. And that was their first attempt to try and get me help. And I was just having none of it. And then these two lads that I drink with bounced off one of them. And he's like, "Mate, what have you got to lose? Like, you tried to quit so many times. I'm not drinking for January. I'm not going to do, I'm doing Stoptober. I'm not going to drink till my birthday. I won't drink till we go on holiday. Then I'll enjoy holiday." And so trying to give myself these weeks or months of sobriety and just crumbling. And I've tried it so many times. All the excuses come in. "Oh, I've done a week. That's long enough for a detox, right? I can have another drink now." And then, poof, of course, you're back off at the races again. So he said, "What have you got to lose? Like, you've lost your house, your home. All I came away from my marriage with was my car and my clothes. Like, I had nothing." So, like, "Do you know what? Yeah, okay." And then went on like a 48-hour bender. I had this weird logic in my head still that if I was going to a rehab and there's crack addicts and heroin addicts, and then there's going to be Andy, I was going to feel like I even had imposter syndrome going into rehab. Like, how mad is that? Like, I've got to measure up to everybody else in there. So if I went to prove that I could drink enough to warrant going to rehab, like, just some mad head logic that was just completely distorted. And yeah, they took me in and went to a private residential 12-step treatment center. And that was kind of my introduction to AA and the 12-step program. And NA, I went to CA. Overeaters Anonymous as well. I spent a few meetings in there, but my primary addiction was very much alcohol.
That's the question I was going to ask you actually, because you speak about drugs there a lot, and I mean it's been part of my story as well. But I take it alcohol was you well you've just said there that alcohol is a kind of the main drug, and it's a kind of gateway drug, isn't it? It's like the thing you take before you touch anything else. It's like if you need to touch that before you would take anything else. And yet it's the one that's so socially accepted and so pushed at us from every angle. And yet that's the gateway to all the other drugs that they talk about in the newspapers and on the news about all these drugs that are killing people and ruining lives, but they just don't speak about alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've done the research to know why that is now. And it's fascinating. I've found that obviously going into rehab, I went in on Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2015. And to this day, I haven't drunk alcohol since. So I'm one of the
Amazing.
fortunate few that the first AA meeting was sufficient a motivator to carry on with that process that has kept me sober. What that did for me was, well, first of all, it got me sober and it got me out of the initial addiction phase of alcohol, which is priceless in itself. I'm not belittling that at all. But what that then did was, I came away from needing any pharmaceuticals. So I'd stopped the Ritalin, the antidepressants, and the benzos. I didn't need those anymore because the overpowering symptoms of alcohol addiction were causing such a trauma and such horrendous depression that I needed them at the time. But then getting clear of the booze, I didn't require the pharmaceuticals. So I'm then in this place where, okay, I'm wobbly at this point. Granted, it's all very new, but I just knew that I couldn't drink again. My step one was rock solid. But it gave me this platform to then do all the steps, get a sponsor, start getting back into employment, sorting my finances out, being able to do the step five, step four, five, step eight, and nine. Clearing all the wreckage and all of that it's just so important because they always say, do the next right thing. So for me, doing the next right thing eradicates guilt. And I just had carrying so much guilt around with me constantly. So if I can just stop adding to that bag of guilt on a daily basis, I'm not going to make it any worse. That was my logic. But for me now, it's also about doing the next healthy thing because it's when people say, "Oh, stay in the middle of the boat in early recovery," but for me, that's long term. Because as soon as I start going to these extremes of hormones, mood, fatigue, not that it will give me an alcohol craving now after 11 years, but it's almost like it's the whole kind of Yoda Darth Vader thing. It's like you've got to choose a Jedi. You've got to keep moving towards that healthy, guilt-free, reduced victim mindset route. And pity and self-loathing were absolutely catastrophic in my life. I was wearing those badges for years. Poor old Andy. And being well and healthy and guilt-free just completely eradicates that. And that's kind of what AA has done for me, is it's given me the platform and the clean slate and the clean living to know what is me and what is true, what is truly me. So yeah, I've still got ADHD, I've still got autism, I still have massive hormonal swings as a consequence of those. But that's me. It's not a hormonal swing or a depressive spike or anxiety spike because of external source substances now. It's entirely how I'm supposed to feel. And so I now built this, I think they say toolbox in AA, don't they? But I've kind of now developed coping strategies just to get healthier and healthier and healthier as I go on, to be able to deal with these swings and just the self-knowledge that I now have. Because I knew that just stopping drinking, I had to look for the root cause of my alcohol consumption. What is causing all of this shit? And I was then able to go back and go, okay, what is the ADHD? What is autism? How do they make me feel? Why am I still in complete squeaky clean sobriety, still having these massive swings in mood? It's freed me up to be able to go and learn about that. And I've been and got a qualification from King's College London in ADHD. Just the hyper focus that I've put in initially to stop that first drink. That was my major, major motivation to learn about myself, was to never drink alcohol again. But actually, what it's turned into further down the line is this level of self-knowledge and understanding that just is so freeing that I know it's not because I'm a bad person or because I keep messing up or I'm a burden on society, a burden on my partner, my parents, my family. It's none of those things. And it's just built and built to the point where now I'm actually in just so comfortable in my own skin. Most of the time, still have shit days, but like 90% of the time, I'm happy with who I am because I'm doing the next right thing, the next healthy thing. I'm cracking on with life, and things are good, man.
Andy, can I just chip in there? Can I just listen to you talking? Can you, I don't know if it's actually as simple as this, but can you explain why somebody with, say, ADHD might be more prone to, really sort of hitting the drink hard, like you've just described there, and find it difficult to sort of break that cycle over somebody who, who may not, have the same diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's entirely hormonal. I'm apologizing to female kind everywhere I go that I was the ignorant dickhead bloke who just thought, oh, women are hormonal once a month. That was about the extent of my knowledge of hormones. Turns out I'm one of the most hormonal beings you'll ever have the misfortune to come across. I'm incredibly hormonal. The nature, the absolute nuts and bolts of what ADHD is a dopamine deficit. So people say that it should be called dopamine deficit disorder, not attention deficit disorder. And the impact that that has on mood, motivation, energy is profound. And they reckon that people with ADHD by their 18th birthday have 20,000 more negative social interactions than their neurotypical peers, which sounds like a lot, but it's three a day. And I can tell you that when you're getting expelled from two schools, kicked out of home at 16 at the time of your GCSEs, it's a lot more than three a day. And so you kind of then go into this mindset of wanting to please or impress your primary caregivers, your teachers, the adults around you, constantly trying to, I want to do well at this today, sir. Mom, 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 look at me, aren't I doing really well? And you're trying to sort of put that positivity on you on your behavior, but ultimately there's still so much that comes with the condition that gets you in trouble. And so you're just constantly in bollocking after expulsion and then at home. And then you just get to the point where you're like, do you know what? Bollocks. And so that's when this more erratic behavior comes in because there's two parts of your brain. There's the limbic system, which is your chimp, which is defensive and aggressive and egotistical. The ego is actually a manifestation of the limbic system, and you want to be better than everybody else, but you can't. And then there's the prefrontal cortex and this whole internal dialogue. The prefrontal cortex is supposed to quash these stupid ideas that your chimp comes up with, but the other role of dopamine is the neural modulator for your prefrontal cortex. So it doesn't work properly. So physically, you are at this disposition where one, you cannot stop your chimp being impulsive and doing what it's doing because it is defensive and because it's in trouble again and because it's in this kind of sympathetic fight or flight mode constantly. And you've got excess cortisol and adrenaline and noradrenaline running around your system all the flipping time, which makes you hyperactive, can't concentrate, and impulsive. And then side of ADHD that people don't see is the chronic fatigue, the depression, all the stuff that comes from the dopamine deficit state that we do our best to mask and hide and not show anybody. But then as soon as we do get a positive reinforcement for a behavior, and we do release the happy hormones, your endorphins, your sort of your oxytocin, your serotonin, whatever it may be, we then have massive spikes in dopamine. And so that motivates us then to do more of that behavior. And so all of a sudden, someone says, oh, you're doing really well, Andy. Yeah, I'm doing really well. And you get this kind of positive feedback. And so you do it more and more and more and more and more. And then all of a sudden, poof, your dopamine crashes and you go back into that deficit state. And then you don't want to move, and then you feel horrific and depressed and anxious and crap. And so you've just got these constant all or nothing nature of ADHD. And so, like I say, when you kind of reach the point where it's been like 10 years of not being able to hold a job down and comparing yourself to your peers who are much more stable and neurotypical and getting on with life, and you realize that alcohol is absolutely incredible at producing dopamine. And so you drink lots of it, whether you're aware of it in the early days or not, whether you're addicted to it in the early days or not. Nevertheless, that behavior is starting to get ingrained in your chimp's sort of coping strategy toolbox, if you like. And ultimately, you drink more and more and more and more of it. But it doesn't have to be alcohol. It can be sugar. It can be gaming. It can be porn. It can be, then it's pick your poison. It's whatever your chimp has access to make itself feel better from this constant state of depleted dopamine. It will just get carried away with and run away with until you're able to admit you're addicted to it. So that is kind of the very sort of nuts and bolts of ADHD and why we're just constantly trying to stimulate ourselves to produce dopamine.
Thank you for describing that. You described it so well, and I can kind of, feel you what it's done to you, and feel your pain, if you
Yeah,
know what I mean. It's like flipping
no,
heck, you've been
no,
going
that's
through
real.
so much for so long, and it's like, I'm 55 in a few couple of weeks' time. Hint, hint, Kelly. Although,
You're not Ian.
I am. I know it's hard to believe, isn't it? But anyway, but what I was saying about that was, I think about so many people who I know my age who I've known over the years and think, God, what you just described, Andy, there, you've described people I know really well who their moods just spike up and down. And I'm not skilled enough to diagnose them. And I also know it's very complicated because things can be mixed with other things. And Kelly, I was reading, I'm still reading Millie's book. We had Millie Gooch on last week, and she's got a new book out called Anxiety. And I was reading about sort of neurodivergence and all and how it can affect us, different people and stuff. And but these things, like you said, Andy, you're a bit younger than me, but even when you were younger, these things just weren't recorded at all, were they? And I
Absolutely.
wonder now how many people of my age and around my age, and certainly older than me, but probably younger than me as well, have just gone through life not knowing all of this. And it's like, you poor guys, because this just sounds, it sounds exhausting.
It's a lot, and you're absolutely right. And like I say, there's still now you can go and spend 1500 quid on a private ADHD diagnosis, and they'll tell you you've got it. Or not got it, as the case may be, but they will not tell you what it is. They'll give you the piece of paper and then you can go to your GP and start approaching. It's not, and that's great because you can then go down the route of medication, which is profoundly beneficial for ADHDers if you get it right, and go and seek the help that is that a diagnosis requires. But they nevertheless will not sit you down and say, here's, you've got ADHD, here's what it is. But the good news is it's not the 80s and 90s anymore. There is the information is out there, but you've got to go and find it. And so it comes back to the whole kind of thing with ADHD is we'll do you tell us something is super important, it doesn't matter. If you tell us something is stimulating, then we will go and do it until the cows come home because the whole concept of that is we are stimulating the dopamine reward pathway with a behavior or a substance. You can say, this is Andy, this GCSE coursework, you've got to get this done now, mate. It's super important. If it doesn't stimulate the reward pathway, it categorically will not get done, which is socially unacceptable, which is another bollocking. So yeah, it's just this whole kind of repeating cycle.
When you were talking there, I was just thinking of all these school kids. I could just see all these school kids. You were talking about the fatigue as well. About, I mean, I wouldn't have even knew that about ADHD, about the fatigue and the kind of downside of it. And you've got all these kids running about with emotions that they don't talk about, feelings that they don't talk about, doing whatever at the weekend, sugar, energy drinks by the bucket, all drinking these energy drinks. We don't actually know what's going on in any of the kind of teenagers' lives, and the ADHD could probably be picked up at school age if you maybe even just started talking about how you feel and how do you deal with this. Do you know, there's no conversations happening in school, even from a kind of lower level of feelings and emotions to understand and to educate them around the fact that alcohol, sugar, porn, all these things are actually used as an escapism of some sort to escape what you're feeling. There's none of that educated, and it just makes me really sad that there's so many people like yourself, Andy, young kids, even in the adult, like Ian said, in the adulthood, kind of living with that, with the fact that we've just got all these immediate, as you say, alcohol helps. Alcohol makes people feel good in the moment. It relieves anxiety. It helps ADHD for a time. And it's just pushed that as every corner as this is what you do to de-stress, to enjoy yourself. And
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. And
just, yeah.
alcohol is profoundly good at what it does in the early days. Like it's amazing at what we're using it for. But then, of course, you do it for 20 years, and the dosage is only going to go in one direction, and the mess that high dosage then causes is often too much to be able to cope with and ultimately deal with. And I've been to AA funerals before now. We had a peer group, a WhatsApp group that I came away from rehab with, and there was, I don't know, 10 of us in it, and there's 4 of us left. Now, at least 3 of those have died. Who knows where the rest are? So we get into such a pickle with the addiction side of these mind-altering substances, that people don't often get an opportunity to get past that to deal with the bigger picture, which is neurodiversity, which it's very upsetting. And I think we need the movement. Like there's been the gay movement, the vegan movement, the trans movement. Love them or hate them, whatever your opinion is of them, it's for the people involved, it's fantastic. And so I think there needs to be the same thing for neurodivergency, for autism, for ADHD, where there's a societal movement to make this stuff more okay, one, okay to talk about and admit to, but just the education level needs to go up in schools and wherever else it can, men's groups, and I think that's going to be an extremely important factor as to people getting this stuff sorted. Because if you Google dopamine deficit state, one of the symptoms is depression. The feeling of hopelessness and depression. And this isn't just like some mamby-pamby sort of, oh, I don't feel great today. This is true clinical depression that if you go to a GP, they will give you SSRIs for this, which again is another strong medication. You get a whole new area of having to monitor yourself through SSRI usage. But the point is, like, I went away a few weeks ago to Cornwall with my partner Sally, and I'd worked really hard. The 3 or 4 weeks build up, we just got loads of stuff sorted out. Kids, work, I've got 3 jobs, and it was a lot. Then we went on holiday, crash time. So I'd had this build up of dopamine getting higher and higher and higher for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then wallop, and I just crashed. And the sensation, I can talk about it to Sal. It's wonderful. It's like I've just had the most almighty dopamine crash. I've had the rug pulled from under my feet. I feel horrific. I need some downtime. Okay, we're going to have some downtime. We're going to sit on the beach. We're going to eat takeaway food. Don't worry about it. Just batten down the hatches, get through that hormonal low. I'll come back. Great conversation to be able to have. However, the point being, keeping it more relevant to alcohol, is the reason or the sensation that I had 12 years ago before I quit drinking was exactly the same as I had 3 weeks ago in Cornwall. The sensation was identical. So I now know that I was drinking because I was hormonally low. In squeaky clean sobriety, it's that sensation is still arriving in my body. It's somewhat predictable, and I can now deal with it in much healthier ways. I don't have to drink it anymore. It's truly a blessing that I don't have to drink on it. But it's still the same. And so I have to be able to expect it's still going to be happening in another 11 years' time. And so part of the message that I'm trying to put out there is not only for ADHDers who do suffer a more extreme version of this dopamine low, that is the condition after all, but for everybody, for every single drinker, non-drinker, is to know and have an understanding of, one, the hormones that are sweeping through our brain and body, and two, what they feel like. And when you're in a deficit state of one of them, it'll pass. They always say, this too shall pass. Hormones fluctuate. And for me, one of the real gems of sobriety is being able to know that about myself, what these hormonal swings feel like, and knowing, truly, truly knowing that it'll pass. And sad to say, they ain't getting any better. And if I could give people that one sort of nugget, is to learn what your hormones are.
You know, listen to you there, Andy. I could actually feel it in my stomach. The amount of times on a Saturday I would be absolutely knackered from the week, like knackered, no energy, not really wanting to talk to anybody. And I'd be like, wait, get a couple of glasses of Prosecco down my neck and I'll be all fine. And that would be a couple of glasses of Prosecco and I would be off and running again. Oh God, when I could have just gave myself that rest.
100%. Well, it's so for me, exactly what you've just described is it could be fobbed off as physical fatigue. You've had a long week, your body is physically tired, and you are now telling yourself that you're in this tired state. You've earned something because you've exerted energy and effort. I'm going to give myself permission for alcohol. But what it sounds like to me, you'd had a hard week, you'd completely depleted all your dopamine, you're now in this fatigue state, wallop there some instant gratification, and bang, your dopamine's back in the game. You weren't tired at all. You weren't physically exhausted. You were just low in dopamine. And that's what it feels like. And
What
it's just, it's, but it, that's, that was a real eureka moment for me, you know?
I love what you said before a while ago. You said about you were full of pity and self-loathing, and you talked about Yoda and Darth Vader. I'm gonna nick that one. That's mine from now on, Andy. The angel and the devil, but I think Yoda and Darth Vader are much better. How did you get out of that sort of pity party for one, if you know what I mean, and that self-loathing? How did you manage to turn yourself around and go, do you know what? I'm going to get ahead of this rather than always sort of like, feeling sorry for myself all the time. What tool did you use, if you know what I mean? Or how did it dawn on you that this is what you needed to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think ultimately you've got to come through that early recovery. I think no matter who you are or what's going on, I think early recovery sucks, and it's scary, and it's emotional, and it's there's detox and withdrawal. So there's the physical side of things, there's the hormone reset, which I kind of touched on. And then there's the fear of change and going through life with no more alcohol, no more Dutch courage. So I mentioned to you guys earlier, it's like no more sex after a couple of drinks, like all these things are suddenly hit home. So you've got to get through that. You kind of, there's no easy really way to sort of muddle through that sort of stuff, but it does pass. But then after that, like I say, like doing the next right thing, doing the next healthy thing, gratitude list. I truly believe that if you are truly grateful, then self-pity cannot coexist. And so it's these little things, it's surrounding yourself with the right people. And then as you move forward, I can't sort of emphasize enough what lifestyle choices have done for me. Like in early recovery, mate, it was just whatever, anything other than drugs and alcohol. So I was eating four bags of Haribo, two tubs of ice cream, and a Chinese in one sitting. Like, don't get me wrong, like I was eating all of it. Like, do whatever you need to do. But then it's almost like a sliding scale. And then all of a sudden, like you eat a little bit less crap, and then you go to the gym. I'm going to rejoin the gym. And then don't rush it. But then all of a sudden, like you then just go for a run and maybe enter a park run or whatever it is. And then just whatever it is for you. Like I'm a sporty guy. So I'm always going to lean on exercise as kind of my delayed gratification option. But then it just seems to have this holistic effect of, when I exercise, I don't want to eat crap. And when I don't exercise, I don't want to eat crap. Then I start to lose weight, and then I start to have less spots, and then I start to feel better. And then it's this whole kind of notion of living in the solution and not the problem. And then as soon as you, like I say, you're making these, it's not hard anymore. Your gut microbiome changes, and you actually want to start eating broccoli and buying super green powders and taking the right supplements. And then when you're not full of carbohydrate and sugar, you don't get the hunger pangs as often. So you can go longer between meals, and your insulin spikes reduce, and you're getting further away from type 2 diabetes. And then all of your body starts to sing. And that's kind of where I got to with it. And I think the whole concept of going to meetings, sharing in meetings, I think when you give it away, it reinforces it. And as that sounds a bit daft and cliche, but it's true. And the whole kind of notion of step 12 is just helping other people helps you. And it really does. And so I think you just build on it, dude. I think there's a lot of personal things, a lot of individual things like cold water therapy. Ain't no one, not, No one's going to be getting in a lake in January in early recovery, and I get that. But it's like when you sort of realize what it's actually doing for you on so many levels, and then it becomes a social thing. So instead of going and sitting, chatting shit in the pub for an entire Sunday afternoon, you do a 5K run and get in a lake. And all of a sudden, you're just buzzing and you're high on life. And I kind of then pushed that. I kind of got to a place where second lockdown actually was brutal. Like the whole concept of an ADHD, a stagnated ADHD is not a good thing. So when someone's told me you can't leave your house, oh my God. Sal has two boys. They're on the brink of strangling each other. They haven't been in school for 9 months. And I was that, it's to this day, the closest that I had come to relapse. So what would that have been? About 5 or 6 years in, maybe. I was flip. I stood up this very sofa to go and pick up a bottle of gin, and that was going to be that. And between standing up and relapsing, I took a left instead of a right, sat down with Sal, like, this is going on right now. You need to know this. I need to do something about this. I need a project. What can I do? And she said, what do you want to do? Like, all the leisure centers are short. You can't go to the gym. You can go in the back garden, do some press ups. Like, what do you need? And it's like, okay, well, hang on a minute. So then we just spent an hour talking about it. It's like, well, how about instead of doing all the things that society expects people to do and being bad at them because I'm ADHD, autistic, dyslexic, and I just kind of, how about what are you good at? Training, exercise, sport. Okay. What do you want to do? Well, I've done some triathlons. Let's develop your triathlons. Let's do that. And I just got this kind of gentle nudge from Sal. And then that was it. It's like ADHD hyper focus then. And it's like, right, okay, what do I want to do? And I set myself the challenge of achieving a Guinness World Record in triathlon, which is insurmountable in one sitting. But then all of a sudden it was a project. And then I was just utilizing everything that I use one day at a time. Like, today I am going to do this, this, and this exercise. Okay, all the AA stuff still is still there. Go to a meeting, share it at meetings, call my sponsor, text another alcoholic. That's still in place, but then it's do this, do this, do this. And it was building and building and building. And then that was an 18-month project and culminated in actually setting a Guinness World Record. But it was done in a way that utilized one, ADHD, two, recovery techniques, and instead of being in the victim mindset, oh my God, I have got to drink gin, going back to that old coping strategy, quick, talk myself out of it, and then brought all the other stuff in that I've learned since then. And yeah, it's not perfect. Nothing's flipped. I set out for two world records, to be fair, and I only got one. So nothing's
Oh,
perfect. I know. And that was the one that I really wanted that I didn't get. But
amazing.
then that comes back to acceptance and gratitude. Acceptance that I didn't achieve that one, gratitude I still got another one. So, it's still, as you're saying, there are necessary coping strategies that I believe there are great ones that are kind of communal, that you sort of taught along the way, but then there's very individual things. Like, if I get a craving now, I'll go in a cold shower. And I know the neurology behind that. It works. It absolutely works. If you were sitting on your sofa at night and you don't want to eat a tub of ice cream, have a cold shower for 10 minutes. See how much you want your ice cream after that. And it's just these little things that just get you through.
I'm not there yet. The ice cream is still definitely winning for the moment.
Yeah,
But before we speak about your Guinness World Record, the whole thing about you saying like getting a plan and a challenge, I think that's great as well. And obviously the connecting with people. So like your community, for instance, the Zooms, you can come on and chat on the Zooms. Ian runs a diet, fitness and wellbeing group within the community as well, because like that, when people get a certain amount of space between them and the alcohol, they then want to start kind of bettering themselves, just eating better, exercising, meditating, all that sort of stuff. And I think being part of a community instead of trying to do it yourself, even before you cross that line into alcoholism, I think having community and kind of, because I remember when I first went to an AA meeting back in 2016, I thought, is this my life? Just AA meetings, just stop drinking and go AA meetings. You need so much more than that. And I think the power of community gives you that hope for sure.
100%, yeah.
Tell us about your Guinness World Record.
So the record itself is most half iron distance triathlons in a year, which is 70. And the one I was setting out for was most in succession. It's a 70.3 mile triathlon, so 1.2 mile swim, 56 mile ride, and then a half marathon, so 13.1. So 70.3. I set out to do 70 of them in 70 days. I built up to that. So at the time that I nearly relapsed, at that point there in COVID, I struggled to run a 10K. Like, legitimately, I had a mate who was training for a marathon and social distancing. We went out for a run, and he just dusted me on this 10K, and I was walking on an uphill. So that's where my fitness was when I started. And so I did 17 sprint distance triathlons, which is 17 miles in 17 days. I did 35 Olympic distance, which is 35 miles in 35 days. And then trained all winter, and arrived at the start line on like the 1st of April, I think it was, I think it was the 1st of April, and my intention was to do 70, and yeah, it was a lot. The build up was fantastic. We had a documentary team following me around, bless them. Just when you were at your most horrifically wiped out stage, you had a camera in your face. It's like the Osbournes, and so. That was happening. Companies were getting involved. I had an ex-England rugby player who was to now turn physio. Just gave me 18 months of free physio. Like, should have been 40 quid an hour, 50 quid an hour, whatever he charges, and just several times a week. Companies were obviously made me ambassador for their online companies and all of this. And there was stuff that was happening that I couldn't have foreseen. And basically, the reason for that was because of how honest I'd been with regards to addiction, recovery, ADHD, alcoholism, all of that. It was all front and center. And so instead of me being, oh my God, now I'm an alcoholic, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other, I've got no missus, no car, no money, and just the flicking psychology of, oh my God, like, look at what I have got to offer people. And so it was like, yes, my name is Andy. I am an alcoholic. I am a cocaine addict. I am in recovery. And here's what I'm setting out to do. So as soon as I owned it and put it out there, people just wanted to see me succeed. I was expecting internet trolls. I was expecting dickheads and naysayers. Didn't get a single one. Not one. People just wanted me to succeed at it, and were helping in every way they could. People were bringing cakes around the run. They went from here and out and back twice. My turning point was a post box turnaround. That was a do that twice to half marathon. And people were leaving post-it notes on the phone, on the post box, for me to pick off and read. And like, just it was just the night. Had two coaches, a physical coach, and then a sports psychologist coach, free. They just like, I've just finished my PhD. I would love to be able to help you with this project. And people were just couldn't do enough for me. The sense of community, as you mentioned earlier, Kelly, was just incredible. And so, yeah, set out and got injured on literally day 36. I was just on day 35, completed it. And on day 36, I had to stop. I had an infection come in. I virtually lost my big toenail. And I had an ingrowing toenail as well. And an infection had got in through the pool water. The red was coming up my leg, and I couldn't put weight on my left leg. And I've had a very, very close mate die of sepsis, and a new mate who had my PT. He was like national MMA champ, does all kinds of triathlons and stuff. And he was on his deathbed because of an infection, and he made it through, fortunately. So I know how severe the implications can be from an infection. So I stopped. And I had 5 rest days with antibiotics. And then on whatever day it would have been, I got back out there and did another block of 35. So 35, 5 days off, day 35. Well, Guinness wouldn't recognize, because I'd said I was setting out to do 70, and I did 35. Guinness saw it as a fail. So there's no record anywhere of 35 in a row. So I had it as an unofficial one.
That's definitely chef. The fact that you go back on the bike and back in the water and back on your feet after 5 days off, I mean, that in itself, once you stop, it's like, I mean, Ian, when you think about doing your half Ironman a few weeks ago, could you have done one the next day?
We're not going to be able to edit. We're not going to be able to release this podcast, I'm afraid, Kelly, because he just puts me in such a bad light. It just makes me look like an absolute sort of loser. I'm just thinking, what I'm thinking is just Again, it's that thing about that pity and self-loathing, and sort of, you could have, well, you did it for a while, for a long time. You were kind of, poor me, I've got this diagnosis. I'm doomed for life. You've somehow managed to sort of, get you've pivoted on it, if to use a modern term, you've pivoted, and now suddenly you're using that what was a weakness and your sort of disability and your sort of thing that was dragging you down and making you sort of worse than everybody around you when everyone else was doing things that you couldn't do. Suddenly you've bounced like a trampoline and you've gone way beyond what anyone normal, if you know what I mean. Sorry, that's not the right word, but anyone who hasn't got that diagnosis could never have done, 35 or 70 sort of versions of that. So you've turned it into a superpower, and that's what I love. And it's kind of it's I hopefully you're going to tell me about your coaching in a minute. You're going to talk about how you help people, but presumably that's what you can do. You can enable people to sort of point them in the right direction, say you can do so much more than somebody else because of this. What trying to tap that potential. Have I called that right?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm a firm believer in because the other thing that having the low dopamine, which means the prefrontal cortex isn't working correctly, which is stopping the chimp doing that stupid shit, which you mentioned earlier. Some of the stupid shit that the chimp wants to do is absolutely incredible. Like if you take winter Olympic athletes, they're on a little sled the size of a tray in Lycra going down an ice tunnel at 100 miles an hour. You're telling me their prefrontal cortex is working correctly? Absolutely not. And they get to the bottom, and then what do they want to do? They want to do it again faster. So if you could get to the point that you're doing something like to that level, something daring. I mean, my other passion in life is marine biology. Absolutely love it. I'm a scuba instructor. Worked in the Philippines and the Caribbean and the Blue Planet Aquarium, and I love being underwater. I think it has the most incredible effect on me, calming effect. But I've swum with 25 species of shark without a cage, like big ones, like tigers, bulls, great hammers, like just in the water with them, like 4.5 meter sharks that could easily bite you in half.
You're mad.
And so that's my prefrontal cortex not working properly. That's telling me, oh, yeah, be all right, get in with them. And so some of the things that enables you to do are people see them as superhuman. I did a dive in the Bahamas with four great hammers, three tigers, and two bull sharks. And it's like shark soup, and you're just jumping in. At me first. Do you know what I mean? And so what an experience. What an utter privilege to be able to go in the water with these things, because I'm not scared, so they don't see me as a fearful prey item, and so they just leave me to it. I leave them to it, they leave me to it, and you're just checking them out, they're checking you out, and it's what an incredible experience. So it's things like that. It's the Olympians, it's the extremists, it's the people going down the entire Amazon, going to the North Pole when you could freeze to death. The list goes on. The guy, the runner of Virgin, Richard Branson, multi-million pound risks because his prefrontal cortex isn't working correctly. So he's like, yeah, okay. Did it work? Yeah, right, I'm a billionaire. And so if you can use it to your benefit, then it can be absolutely profound. But if you're trying to bang your head against the wall doing what neurotypical people are doing, like I did for 20, 30 years, it'll get you very depressed and very drunk. And yeah, that's how I see it these days.
And am I right in thinking there's probably people who are maybe not as sort of with a slightly different sort of diagnosis of ADHD or some other sort of neurodivergence that might not make them as it might not be as profound as yours, perhaps, but they can still be used as a superpower. They might not bounce as high as you bounce, but presumably they can turn that around and use it as a superpower. Would that be right as well?
100%. I think it's a case of knowing you, and I think if we, I know it's this kind of cliche thing, that if we all do what we were put on this planet to do, this how high would the skill level of these things be? And I think if you can find your thing, and you're fortunate enough to give it a go, and it doesn't have to be professionally to start with. It can be a hobby, it can be a side hustle, it can be it's just something that you like enjoy spending your time doing. But eventually, if you can sort of bring it around and you can get paid or you can have some kind of income from it, And all of a sudden, you're doing the thing that one, you're incredibly talented to do, and two, that this advanced dopamine reward pathways and is set upon. Oh my God, like the sky's the limit. And so, yeah, I think anybody with that, and neurotypicals get it too. But then when you start talking about 70 half Ironmans in 10 weeks, it's the equivalent of going four lengths of the English Channel and then cycling and running from Calais to Beijing. Like, and you say that to people, and they're like, you what? But
Madness.
you don't start there. I started with sprint triathlons, and I started, I went to Olympic distance, then I went to half Ironman. And now the guy, this is a German chap, I can't remember his name, but at the time I did it, it was a guy called Sean Conway, has done like 105 full irons in 105 days. Like,
Wow.
for me, that's my, and I've been in a similar scenario, but even for me, that's like, Jesus Christ, that's 15 hours a day for 3 months, four, 3.5 months. So, you know, I think once you kind of are able to embrace it and roll with it and develop it as an ADHDer, then you can take it to levels that people just can't fathom.
And you might have to get you back because we haven't even touched on your coaching, and I
Hello.
want to quickly touch on your coaching now, if that's all right. But if it, with
Yeah.
your permission, I think we might have to have you back so we can talk at some point in the
Yeah.
future about your coaching and how you've been helping other people. Do you mind just quickly just giving us a bit of an introduction into that, please?
So it's ADHD coaching. That's my area of specialty at the moment. It may develop into addiction recovery as well, but for now, I'm just trying to fill that gap between people going through the hard side of ADHD that I've described, and parents watching their GCSE A level age kids going off the rails, and I'm trying to be the guy that can help them by giving them the information. So I'm not a psych, I'm not a counselor, I am a peer mentor. So that means I'm the guy that's been through the shit. I've got all the medals, and I'm staying in the trenches and trying to help people to get a handle on what the condition is, how it's affecting them, and how they can move forward more positively without having to go down the route of terrible coping strategies, depression, addiction, and keep away from that and guide them off as best as I can before they get there. So I've written an 8-part program. It started as a 10. I've got it down to 8. I find it really punchy. And it just talks about the neurology and the psychology and the brain chemistry of ADHD, why there are links to addiction. But then also, I talk about lifestyle choices. So I've derived the six pillars of health: nutrition, exercise, sleep, circadian rhythm, community, and de-stressing. And just try and really impart on people what exactly healthy living is. You know, find them where they're at. You know, try and sort of talk them down from giving themselves a hard time for getting into whatever pickle they're in, and but then we can rebuild, and then hopefully that they go on to thrive with this condition rather than battling with it. So that's what I'm trying to put out there, and I'm going to schools, businesses, doing talks and assemblies. I rent venues for the evening and try and sell tickets to just do talks to get this information out as best as I possibly can.
Amazing. Absolutely love what you're doing, Andy. I think it's
Oh,
just
thanks.
such important work, such important work. And what a way to kind of give back, I suppose, to the kind of help and support that you've had and coming out the other end of your addiction and putting into such something so positive. It's amazing. It really
Thank
is.
you so much. Yeah, it means a lot. It's been a journey. It's been a decent 11 years, but worth it. Like, it is night and day. It really is. So the fear of wondering what life would be like without alcohol, with that such a well ingrained coping strategy in place, and getting rid of it, it's there's no comparison. My life is beyond what I could have ever possibly have fathomed. And the whole concept of, like we said earlier, when I had that family intervention, I thought they'd won the lottery. And Kelly, you said, well, in a roundabout way, I have. You know, so yeah, how lucky am I?
Andy, if people want to get hold of you, how do they go about contacting you or
There's
following you?
0898, only joking. On all your socials, I'm ADHD Andy. So LinkedIn, Insta, Facebook, and ADHDandy.com is the website. So yeah, please get in touch. If I can help, I would love to be able to.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, oh, brilliant, Andy. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry, we're going to have to could ask you so many more questions, but we are going to be over time, aren't we? Definitely,
Yeah.
sort of. I think we've created our longest ever podcast here, Kelly.
I think we
So,
have. I
well
think
done, Andy. Congratulations. There's a world
we
record for you.
have. Yeah. Guys, thank you so much for having me. Really, really
Thank
appreciate it.
you.
It's been really great. Kelly, if you want to get hold of us and join, Andy's talked about community and the importance of community. We've got
Yep.
one right here, haven't we? And we can
We
help with
have.
a load of that. So how do people get in touch with us?
Yep. So you'll get us on socials, Alcohol Uncensored, or the website, alcoholuncensored.co.uk. And I say this every week, if you're a bit apprehensive about joining the community, a bit nervous, don't know what it's like, send me a message and I'll let you have a little mooch about to see if you like it and see if it's something that would help you. Just send us a message, team@alcoholuncensored.co.uk.
Andy, thank you once more. Been really good listening to what you've had to say today. Really, I've learned a lot and I'm inspired by you. So absolutely spot on. Thank you very much.